to celebrate Buddha's great awakening, the occasion for Rohatsu Sesshin. We've been hearing the story leading up to Buddha's awakening from the Mahayana Lalita Vistara Sutra. The extensive presentation of the Buddha's play, the divine play of the Buddha's life, the ritual enactment of various practices that the Bodhisattva undertook, eventually ritually displaying what we call Buddha, the play of Buddha. And we began with the Buddha's leaving home, leaving all the complications of his life in the palace and wandering off into the forest to look for the deathless, the end of old age, sickness, and death. And as was the custom in India at that time for such seekers, he undertook some extreme austerities, almost starving himself to death, eating one juniper berry and one grain of rice a day. He looked like a gray, dusty, withering ghost. So for 6 years, he practiced austerities and very concentrated meditation also. And Buddha is now telling this story in the form of this sutra. Then, monks, it occurred to the Bodhisattva, me, the Buddha, at that time, called the Bodhisattva, there are Shramanas and Brahmins who in times past, present, or future harm themselves by tormenting their bodies, causing great misery and pain. The tortures and great sufferings they experience are not good. So, after 6 years of practicing them, this thought came to him. Maybe this is not good. Self-mortification, which is painful, unworthy, and unprofitable. And therefore, monks, I further reflected, though their actions and attainments are much greater than the highest teachings of ordinary people, they do not bring the highest wisdom into view. They're not on the route to enlightenment. This is not the path that will bring about the disappearance of future births, old age, and death. The path of enlightenment, of awakening, which brings an end to future births, old age, death, and suffering, is other than this. And monks, the thought came to me, you might have heard this part of the story, the thought came to him, in my father's garden when I was a boy, seated in the shade of a jambu tree, detached from desire, free from that which is non-virtuous, I attained the first meditation, the first dhyana, the first Zen meditation, in which there is observation and reflection, a meditation endowed with joy and pleasure born of solitude. Remembering his childhood, how he kind of spontaneously entered this dhyana meditation. And I proceeded on to the second, third, and fourth meditation, and this I sustained. This is the path of enlightenment which will lead to the disappearance of the miseries of birth, old age, sickness, and death. This was my thought. And there followed for me the clear perception that this was the path to enlightenment. Not the complete path, but that this kind of joyful concentration was the way. Though the Buddha had been practicing concentration, it seems like in the descriptions of these austere concentrations, he was like doing various forced kinds of meditations where he would try to stop breathing completely. Maybe what we now consider pranayama practices, maybe some extreme forms. He says he would stop his breathing and the winds would rush through his skull and things like this. But these are just settled, very relaxed, calm, concentrated meditations, these dhyanas. There also came to me the thought, on a path where one becomes exhausted and weak, one cannot manifest complete enlightenment. And if, moreover, I approached the Bodhimanda, the seat of wisdom, with strength of knowledge and wisdom, but with a weakened body, I could not devote my last existence to compassion. This last birth in the human realm. Like if I just make it to Buddhahood and then drop dead of hunger and exhaustion, then I can't devote my life to compassion, which I want to do. So again, this is, for those who missed the earlier passages in this Mahayana version of the Buddha's life story, the Buddha's vow of practicing for the benefit of all beings keeps appearing from early on, which in the Pali Canon version of the story, basically these celestial beings have to convince the Buddha to teach to help others. You could say those celestial beings are like Buddha's compassionate vow, but in this case, he's consciously remembering that even practicing the austerities, he says, is a demonstration to help beings. So I don't want to approach the Bodhimanda, the awakening place. In Japanese, we translate Bodhimanda as dojo, the way place. And I think originally referred to Buddhist temples and now refers to all kinds of ways, like there's Aikido dojo and Taiko dojo. So the way, which is one way to translate Bodhi, can be manifest in all these different forms. And they each have a particular place to practice it. So the original Bodhimanda was this particular seat under this particular tree. And I don't want to approach that seat with a weakened body where I could not devote my last existence to compassion. Then the devas, out of sympathy for being so exhausted, understanding clearly my thoughts and deliberation, came to me and said, Oh, holy being, do not partake of rough food as you intend. We will insert strength into you through your pores. The celestial beings, these devas, can inject nutrition through the pores of beings. So they, a very subtle kind of food. And amongst this thought occurred to me, if the devas were to inject this food through my pores to keep me alive, I would be able to say that I was actually not eating, and the people in the neighborhood would see me as not eating, but this would be like a falsehood, because I actually would be being fed. And so to avoid this lie, the bodhisattva did not heed the devas, but maintained his intention of eating substantial food, regular human food. It's kind of interesting little point here that the Buddha's like, thanks for the offer, and that would be nice, and I wouldn't have to bother stopping for oryoki meals and stuff. I could just keep sitting zazen, because you could inject the food while I'm sitting. But I want to just, this is my play here, right? This is the bodhisattva's enactment of this ritual that all the Buddhas have done. And part of the play is that I want to like do this looking like a kind of a pretty regular human. I want to like eat food like the regular humans do, because there might be some good thing that comes of this. And I think there was a good thing that came of it, even though he could have survived otherwise. And so a monk, after 6 years devoted to austerities, the bodhisattva arose from his seat and spoke these words, I will eat solid food, such as dal, molasses, and boiled rice. However, monks, the five companions of good family that were practicing with me, reflected by the achievements of this path, the Shramana Gautama will never be able to manifest the saintly wisdom which is above the highest human knowledge, as he's now eating food in abundance, and as he's begging food, he's clearly an ignorant and stupid fellow. And with this thought, withdrawing from the presence of the bodhisattva, they traveled to Varanasi and took up residence at Isipatana near Varanasi in the Deer Park. We know later the Buddha finds them there and teaches, sets in motion the wheel of Dharma. Later, when the bodhisattva had first begun to practice austerities, 10 young village girls came to see him. They had continued to honor and serve him, although it was these other 5 men of good family who generally attended on him, giving him the juniper berry, grain of rice, or sesame seed. So these young girls now prepared several kinds of food which they offered to the bodhisattva. Now, we could hear this as a kind of like a sort of sexist comment that like, well, the men were like into like giving the Buddha 1 sesame seed and grain of rice and juniper berry a day, but these the girls of the village actually like, he should have some good food actually. So from the first moment the bodhisattva had begun to practice austerities, Sujata, daughter of the head villager, offered food for 800 Brahmins so that the bodhisattva might end his ascetic practices and mortifications and regain his strength. So she knew that he wouldn't take her food, but she made these offerings to the other practitioners in the town and dedicated the merit of that offering to the wish that the bodhisattva would eventually take food. And she made this this vow, this wish, may the Bodhisattva, having received food from me at some point, attain perfect and complete enlightenment and become a Buddha. That was the prayer she uttered at the time when he wasn't willing to receive it. And then the Buddha says, the saffron robes which I had worn for 6 years had become extremely worn, and the thought came to me, how fine it would be if I were to find something else with which to cover myself. So not only is he going to take some food, but he's going to get some new patched clothing, because his other patches were basically gone. And I noticed this dusty rag, a funeral cloth wrapping a girl of the village who just died. And so picking it up, I picked it up, this dusty cloth, and the gods were amazed. The great being is picking up this totally dusty funeral rag. And then the Bodhisattva thought, I found this dust-covered cloth. It would be good to find some water and wash it. And he found some water and washed it, and then sewed the pieces of rag into a robe. Today this place is still called Pamsukula Sivana, the sewing of the dust rag park. Pamsukula is these, Dogen likes to talk about these dust-covered rags. He says the best thing to make an okesa or a rakasu out of is Pamsukula, Japanese funzo. So then in the middle of the night, the gods had spoken to Sujata, the daughter of Nandika, head of the village of Uruvilva, saying, Sujata, the one for whom you have made many offerings, has ceased the practice of mortifications and is now ready to receive pure and abundant food. Formerly you prayed, after partaking of the food prepared by me, may the Bodhisattva attain perfect, supreme, and complete enlightenment. Now do what must be done. This is why I say it seems that part of the enactment of the play here is that if the Buddha just received food through his pores from the celestial beings, he would not be able to fulfill Sujata's vow that after partaking food offered by me, will the Bodhisattva attain perfect enlightenment. So Sujata heard this and immediately took the milk of 1,000 cows, drew it from it 7 times the purest cream, and poured this cream together with the freshest and newest rice into an earthen pot which she put on a new fireplace. And in the midst of this special food, as she prepared it, there appeared auspicious signs, a Srivasta, a Svastika, a Nandyavarta, a lotus, a Varadamana, and other signs of blessing. Sujata thought, since such signs appear, there can be no doubt, after taking this food, the Bodhisattva will attain perfect, supreme, complete enlightenment. Then, monks, the Bodhisattva went to the home of Sujata and sat upon the seat prepared for him, and Sujata offered the Bodhisattva a golden bowl filled with milk and honey. At that moment, The Bodhisattva thought, now that Sujata has offered such food to me, there can be no doubt. After partaking it, I will attain perfect, supreme, complete enlightenment of a Buddha. So then he ate this food. He went down to the river Nairanjana and bathed. And as soon as the Bodhisattva had eaten, his body regained its former exceedingly beautiful color through the strength of his merits and the force of his wisdom. The 32 signs of a great being reappeared, as did the 80 secondary marks and the brilliant light that radiated from his body. The next chapter is called The Walk Toward the Bodhimanda, Toward the Dojo. And we've also been looking into the past couple of days the nuts and bolts practices of Buddha's meditation as presented in the Sandinirmocana Sutra, Sutra Unraveling the Deep Mysteries. We talk about many things in Zen, including the nuts and bolts specific practices of meditation. I'm fond of bringing that up in my past, and many Dokusans I would try to explore these intricacies of meditation practice. I remember one time in Dokusan with Zoketsu Norman Fisher, and talking about these things, and he said at the end something like, yeah, it's always good to have some shop talk. Shop talk for Zen students is like, how do you exactly do you practice shamatha and vipassana? So, Buddhist meditation, for those arriving today, as you may know, is sometimes divided into these two aspects of shamatha, calm abiding, and vipassana, or insight. And this sutra unlocking the mysteries, this Mahayana sutra, is the main source for the nuts and bolts details of the of specific meditation practices. In fact, I can't even think of other Mahayana sutras that really get into like the details of sitting meditation practice and how to direct the mind in different ways, at least in this level of detail, particularly about shamatha and vipassana. So, this is chapter 8 in the Tibetan version, the questions of Maitreya, Bodhisattva. In the Chinese version, this chapter is called Analyzing Yoga. And this sutra is considered to be one of the bases for the Yogacara school of Buddhism. So, we have one version. The title is called Buddhist Yoga. So it's this is mind yoga in this chapter. And the body's involved too, of course. And it begins with the Bodhisattva Maitreya asking the Buddha, the Bhagavan, the Blessed One, Bhagavan abiding in what and depending upon what the bodhisattvas in the great vehicle, the Mahayana, cultivate shamatha and vipassana, calm abiding and insight. And the Buddha replied, Maitreya abiding in and depending upon an unwavering resolution to basically teach Dharma to help others and to realize complete, perfect enlightenment, bodhisattvas cultivate shamatha and vipassana. So, bodhisattvas in the great vehicle practice meditation with this compassionate wish to benefit others, to realize complete awakening in order to benefit others, and to teach beings Dharma to help them. One could even say specifically, if it would be helpful for beings to learn how to practice shamatha and vipassana, then one has to practice them in order to like teach that to others. And then the Buddha says that there's these four objects of observation of shamatha and vipassana. And the object of observation, the meditation object we're talking about, the object of observation in meditation for shamatha, for calm abiding practice, is what's called non-conceptual images here. And we talked about how we could also see that as an image that's just a plain concept with no elaboration. So an image with no conceptual elaboration. Like, for example, the breath, when you're to practice calm abiding, and when you're attending to the breath, it actually is, there's actually a concept there of the breath. We might not think of it as a concept, we're just trying to follow the sensation, but I'd say it's a subtle concept of the breath. If you want to call it non-conceptual image, that's what the sutra looks like, it literally says. But we could also see it as a subtle conceptual image of the breath, or the body, if you're attending to the physical posture. Just mindfulness of the body is that there's a subtle mental image of the body, but there's no conceptual elaboration around it, like how's my breath doing, or how's the body doing, and you're not really thinking about conceptually elaborating on these images for the practice of shamatha. However, for the practice of vipassana, the object of observation is conceptual images, which could be Dharma teachings or thoughts. And conceptual elaboration is allowed for vipassana. And then there's two objects that are objects of observation for both shamatha and vipassana when they're combined. And they're basically, to abbreviate, suchness or emptiness, and the realization of the transformation of the basis, or Dharmakaya, or Buddhahood, we could even say, the object of observation for the union of shamatha and vipassana is suchness, emptiness, and Buddhahood itself. Kind of summarizing. Yes.
Thank you. Using words like concepts and non-conceptual, and then I start getting confused. But let's go to the breath for a minute. So sometimes when I'm sitting zazen and I'm breathing, and sometimes I just can't get enough. Sometimes I'm thinking, but and I'm not just thinking, but I just. It gets constricted a little bit.
The breath.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So then I straighten my posture, and then it feels better.
Uh-huh.
But I also think about it. Am I sitting up straight?
Yeah.
It's kind of okay, but then I start with the terms, the concepts, and all the different terms. Then I start getting confused.
Uh-huh.
Am I doing this right? Am I, you know, I just like it when the breath is nice and open.
Yeah.
So it's not a problem, but then I don't know if I'm doing the right thing.
Yeah, well, of course, we do think while we're sitting in zazen, and that's natural. So we could say this is kind of an idealized thing, or it's more like the direction we're aiming for the practice. If we're intending to practice shamatha, or this calm abiding, in order to really settle the mind to get it ready for vipassana. Then the intention is to let go of conceptual thinking. And we do, like you say, get distracted and think of other things. And sometimes we think actually really good, appropriate thoughts, like, how's my posture? Oh, like, let's straighten up a little. That's kind of conceptual thinking. And I would call that kind of thinking, thinking almost like in accord with vipassana. As we're going to see later, it's like it's helpful guidance. It's conceptual thinking, but it's helpful. And then the postures, so I can think, let's straighten up the posture. My breathing feels kind of restricted. We might think, let's take a really deep breath and exhale fully and settle back down into the breath. So that kind of like, we might say that to ourselves. I would call that, according to how the sutra is talking, a practice, not exactly vipassana itself, as the sutra will say, but a practice in concordance with vipassana, or it's similar to vipassana, it's in a line with it, and it's helpful. And then we straighten the posture, we open the body a little more, we take the deep breath, and then we don't have to maybe think. For a little bit, we can settle back into it, the body and the breath. And then we just have the plane attending to the physical sensations. And that's what I would understand as one example of non-conceptual image is just the breath. There's no concept, there's no thinking. Thinking and concept are almost the same. There's no thinking or concept about the breath. Sometimes we're just present with the sensations. And I'm just adding this part to say that those sensations we could also look at as a very basic concept, but without any elaboration around it. Conceptual elaboration is another way of saying discursive thinking, adding extra concepts to the plain concept of the breath. Or the body. So that's where we got to yesterday. And then Maitreya asks, Bhagavan, abiding in and depending upon these four objects of observation of shamatha and vipassana, how do bodhisattvas seek shamatha and become skilled in vipassana? And I'm going to skip ahead a little bit here because there's some confusing things that may not be helpful to bring up at this time. This is just going to, first Buddha's going to talk about shamatha. With continuous inner attention, they, bodhisattvas, mentally attend to that mind which is mentally contemplated by any mind. So this is a kind of funny phrase here. So he doesn't say to practice shamatha, they attend to this non-conceptual image of the breath. Here in this Mahayana Sutra that I feel is often reminiscent of a lot of Zen teachings, the bodhisattvas actually attend to the mind. And in this case, that mind which is mentally contemplated by any mind. And I don't know about if that how accurate that translation is, but my understanding of this and fits into the rest of the context as this goes on, we could also say it's like the mind, the aspect of the mind that's always present and available and pretty much the same anytime you look at it. That's why we could say that aspect of the mind that can be thought of from any mind, like from an angry mind or a loving mind, for example. You can look back at this underlying mind that could be contemplated by a happy mind, a sad mind, an angry mind, an agitated mind, or a calm mind. As I mentioned, the image of like conceptual images appearing on a movie screen of our mind. This is kind of like the screen itself. The plain white movie screen is like this, you know, like the images can like look back at the screen anytime, and any image can contemplate that screen. The mind that can be contemplated by any mind, or the mind that's behind all the conceptual thoughts. There's a still present awareness always here, all the time. We could say beneath our thoughts, in between our thoughts. These are kind of like, it's hard to talk about this, right? But these are images, conceptual images I'm offering that point towards this experience that we may be familiar with. If there's some kind of like agitation going on the surface of our experience, but then we kind of have the sense that behind that there's some stillness and non-agitation at the same time. And so shamatha, in this case, the practice shamatha, is looking back through all these conceptual stories on the surface, back to the still aware aspect of mind that's not really changing and not very interesting, which is why it's kind of hard to attend to it. Like when you're watching a movie, it's pretty hard to like look at the screen behind it. Almost impossible, maybe, right? Like, oh, that's a cool screen. Oh, but it's so, the images are so, you know, colorful and alluring. But in fact, the screen is right there. We are actually looking at the screen, right? it's just covered with these images. So I think this is the way this practice could be done. It's going to be a little different by every person. I think it takes some creativity and, you know, finding your own way. So I offer an image like the movie on the screen. For me, that just playing with that, the sesshin, has been helpful. Helpful to look back at the underlying mind stream, yes. I don't think so.
Well, he's a photographer that leaves the lens open for a really long time, for hours, on the movie screen. And what you get when your lens is open for a really long time is the white screen. And he's taking the image of the movie, but he's
That's a great image, yeah. That maybe if we Yeah, if our lens is open for long enough to the movie on the screen, that's why we're sitting for 7 days. then we can maybe start to see this screen beneath. I bring up these kind of teachings particularly in Sesshin because we just have hours and hours of sitting, right, to like explore the mind, and this is one way. So to practice, cultivate the practice of shamatha, they attend to that mind which can be contemplated by any mind. Now, the Chinese version of Thomas Cleary sounds completely different, right? And it is quite literal in the Chinese. It looks like, he says, they attend to the inner stream of the meditating consciousness. So at that section, that's the way the Chinese put that phrase. They attend to the inner stream of the meditating consciousness, which now we have this image of the movie screen. Can you see how it's like there's this stuff on the surface and then there's the screen, the inner screen of the mind. In this case, it's emphasizing that it's not static. Actually, it's a stream, a flowing stream we could call stream of awareness. But not like the stream of awareness, like thoughts, but the actual just open awareness where nothing's really happening. Now, is the mind really like divided into these two parts like this? I don't know how the mind works, but as a meditation practice, there is such a tradition of looking back at this inner stream of the meditating consciousness. Now, in Zen, we have stories like a monk coming to Yangshan and Yangshan saying, where are you from? And Yangshan said, from Santa Cruz. and Yangshan said, do you think of that place often? And the monk said, I'm always thinking of it. I'm always involved in like discursive conceptual thinking about Santa Cruz and other things. And Yangshan gives these instructions, which we could hear as very similar shamatha instructions. He says, reverse the mind, reverse thought and think of the thinking mind. Reverse your thought and think of the thinking mind. Turn the light around and look back at this this underlying inner stream of the meditating consciousness, which we could call the thinking mind. Instead of attending to the thought, the conceptual thoughts, look back at the thinking mind, that where the thoughts come forth. You can't maybe exactly find like a thought, how a thought emerges from this mind. You can't catch it that quick, but again, as this kind of, this is an instruction to reverse the usual mind that's looking at conceptual images and look back at non-conceptual or non-conceptually elaborated image of the thinking mind itself. And then Yangshan says, the thinking mind, the mind is the thinker and the thought of is the environment. In the thought of the environment, there's mountains, rivers, earth, animals, people, houses, things. And when you turn around and look back at the thinking mind, are there so many things there? Are there so many conceptual images there? And the monk says, well, when I get here, I don't see anything at all. I don't see any conceptual images on the white screen, in the inner stream of the meditating consciousness. There's nothing happening. So this is challenging, right? But in an extended retreat like this, we might sometimes touch upon that place, right, where we're just still. And then we could check to see, is that seem like that lines up with that image of this underlying mind. And I think sometimes we might be able to approach it while the conceptual images are going on the surface. We kind of get in touch with what's behind them while they're still happening. And then by attending to that blank screen, then the stuff on the surface just kind of starts dissolving. And maybe it's still happening, but it's like the movie's still happening, but we're just attending to the screen so diligently that we're not paying attention to the movie. Now, of course, this is very challenging. This is hard to do, even when we have a lot of sitting. So I don't say this like, and so just get to work, and every period should just be like this. I think we know that this is challenging, but here's the Buddha's instructions for bodhisattvas who want to practice shamatha. With continuous inner attention, they mentally attend to that mind which is mentally contemplated by any mind. Or they mentally attend to the inner stream of the meditating consciousness. And just to skip ahead, later he's going to say another similar image. Maitreya asks, at what point do bodhisattvas solely cultivate shamatha? And the Buddha says, when they attend to the uninterrupted mind with continuous mental attention. So that's another third version. The uninterrupted mind is like the screen, is just, it never changes, and it's never interrupted. The movie might be interrupted, but the screen just is always just the screen. The uninterrupted mind, the inner stream of the meditating consciousness, the thinking mind itself, as opposed to the thoughts. Also, it's when there's no thoughts happening, it's the mind that doesn't think. So, Dogen's essential instructions for meditation that we chanted this morning, just think of not thinking. And maybe even more accurately translated as think of that which doesn't think. You can hear that as the same instruction too. Think back to the movie screen that's not thinking. It's alive and bright and aware, but it's not thinking. There may be thinking happening, but there's some aspect of the mind that's not thinking. So we could say the mind that's thinking is, you know, if you're thinking back to the thinking mind or the thinker, it's the same mind that doesn't think also. Does that make sense? Sometimes there's thoughts coming out, but we're looking to the source of the thoughts. Sometimes there's no thoughts coming out, but we're still looking back to that same source. So that's... and then the physical and mental pliancy that arises through engaging this practice in this way and continuing in this practice is called shamatha. This is how bodhisattvas seek shamatha. So this is just making the point that there's the practice leading to shamatha. That's the practice of turning back to look at this, at the still mind that's not churning up a bunch of conceptual stuff. But the result of that meditation is called prashrabdi in Sanskrit, which means like physical or mental pliancy, or work pliancy, workability, serviceability. It's like this mind of ease and joy. It's actually peaceful and joyful. And It's a lightness, and it's physical and mental. So the, and it's called, and that's called the state of calm abiding. So the culmination of that practice is when the mind is actually really relaxed and calm and totally alert at the same time. And the body actually, which may seem like a strange thing with all this sitting, how could the body ever like not be a total annoyance on the third day of Sesshin? But I think we know, right, that there's sometimes that experience, maybe after many days of tortuous body pain, where we just are totally relaxed and surrendered into this, not trying to do anything anymore, and the body feels light and at ease. And there may still be pain there, but it's not, we're relaxed, we're so relaxed in the pain that it's okay. So this physical and mental pliancy, it's relaxed, but interesting that the word uses pliancy. It's like this workability, it's like the mind that's like really ready. You could also call it like a state of total readiness, and it's like really open for whatever's next. And that's the mind that's ready for Vipassana. It's like, I'm calm, I'm relaxed, I'm just alert and settled here. And I could just go on this way, but actually I'm willing to actually like do some conceptual stuff even. I'm that willing. So, to be continued. The state of physical and mental pliancy is a shamatha. Now we, this third layer of Rohatsu talks is Hakuin Zenji's Rohatsu exhortations. So seven talks from a 7-day Rohatsu Sesshin. The third night, Hakuin said to the monks, the Tathagata's true Dharma eye treasury, the Shobogenzo, has been transmitted from teacher to student. This is called the Bodhisattva of transmitting the lamp. So you could say the transmission is actually a Bodhisattva. That's what it sounds like. The Tathagata's true Dharma eye treasury is well protected. This is called the Bodhisattva of Dharma protection. The relationship between the teacher and members of the Sangha is like the relationship between transmitting the lamp and protecting the Dharma. When the teacher and the Sangha are not in harmony, the great Dharma does not flow. Therefore, protecting the Dharma must be regarded as of paramount importance. So, Sesshin practice, staying in harmony, all of us, living together in harmony as we sit, walk, eat, clean up, and go about the day is of paramount importance. In ancient days, Kobo Daishi, that's Kukai, the Japanese founder of Shingon, the Japanese Vajrayana, Kobo Daishi prayed to Vairochana Buddha and asked who would be the best Dharma-protecting Bodhisattva. Vairochana Buddha said, there is no one better than Benzai Ten, the goddess of water and a protecting figure of Dharma. Even if the transmission of the lamp has taken place, if there's no aid from the Dharma-protecting Bodhisattva, Buddha Dharma will not flourish. For this reason, protecting the Dharma is essential. Now, these seem like kind of strange and random talks, I must admit. But this is like a little flavor of Hakuin's spontaneous thoughts in Sesshin. Zazen is the foundation of all spiritual paths. In the Shinto tradition, our body is considered to be the condensation of heaven and earth, while heaven and earth are considered to be our great vast body. 7 generations of celestial deities, 5 generations of earthly deities, and 8 million other deities are all enshrined in our very body. If you want to serve these enshrined deities, you must observe the saying in the Shinto tradition, unless you govern the head of the spirit, you cannot serve the deities. To govern the head of the spirit is none other than Zen Samadhi. So whatever he's talking about, the way to make offerings to and invoke the Dharma protectors and to protect the harmony of the Sangha is all none other than Zazen. Okay, so erect your spine, fill your tanden with qi, fill your dantian with qi, sit straight, not even a speck of delusion is in your eyes to see, in your ears to hear, then purify the 6 roots, the 6 senses. That is the moment when both celestial and earthly deities are properly revered. The virtue realized by even one sitting must not be belittled. Therefore, Master Dogen said, a day of diligence is a day of preciousness. 100 years of laziness brings 100 years of regret. How scary. Watch out! May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable. I vow to become it.